welcome to WNHH Radio's Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Antonio Reyes helps make New Haven tick. He's an assistant chief of police here in town. He just got back from Quantico, Virginia, where he underwent special training at the FBI Academy, including a grueling trip down the yellow brick road. Assistant Chief Reyes is here in the WNHH studio today to tell us all about that, and a special thanks to Yale New Haven Hospital for providing support for today's program. Welcome to the studio. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me, Paul.
We've had you in our salsa studio on the other end of the suite.
Yes.
This is your first time in our English language.
Yes, it is.
So I hope you enjoy. But you've just been back from quite an experience, right? 3 months, was it, in Virginia?
Yes, almost 3 months.
And when were you down, from when to when?
Went down to July 10th. Mm-hmm. And we graduated September 15th.
So what was this thing like? Is it hard to get into this? Do you get invited? Is it what kind of people go to this training at Quantico?
So yes to all of that. So you get selected. The FBI provides departments from around the country, around the world actually, slots to go and attend this training. There are two trainings conducted per year, two sessions. And departments or members of the departments are invited from all over the country and the world. So your chief recommends you, and you know the FBI approves you through a background process. There's a process that they go through before you can be accepted.
And is this for top cops? Does anyone have to be an assistant chief or something?
You have to
like
be
that?
At least a lieutenant or above.
And what are they training you for? To be able to run departments or just to have more management experience, latest law enforcement techniques?
Yeah, so The basic focus or the main focus of the academy is to bring law enforcement executives from around the country and the world together to discuss, you know, the leading issues in policing and the prevalent issues in policing. So they bring you together for networking because they believe that it's, you know, they believe in the enrichment part of the program.
So hanging out is part of the deal.
It is. It is. Getting to know people, making connections that you probably otherwise would have never made, really expanding your reach, so to speak, and being able to learn and exchange ideas is an integral part of the program.
And how many people were in this program?
There were over 220, I think 224 to be exact.
Mm-hmm. And so you spent close to 3 months and you had classes, but it was also physical, right? And why is that? You said it was a grueling physical challenge. If you're talking about police executives, why do they need to kick your butt to be in physical shape?
Yeah, that's the philosophy there that it's an important. It's part of preparing you holistically. They understand the grueling aspects of the job, and they understand that as executives, as we move up, we probably tend to be less active and certainly less. And more sedentary. And so they're really just reminding us of the importance of staying healthy and staying healthy, just not physically, but mentally and spiritually. So
and part of that physical aspect of Quantico training, the FBI Academy, you told me was something called the Yellow Brick Road. What was the Yellow Brick Road?
So the Yellow Brick Road is a course that was created by the Marines. It's a course that the Marines go through. That has that goes through the woods, and it's about 6.1 miles. And you go through the woods, and you go through over 21 obstacles going through the woods, and then you all meet at the finish line. And so it's really a culmination of the work that you're doing physically throughout.
So over weeks 3 months, and this is running. You run through the woods.
Yes, you're running through the woods.
And tell me if I remember this correctly. The first third, you're just running.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second third, you go over these obstacles. The third, you're running again.
Correct.
And what kind of obstacles are there in the woods?
You know, you're climbing over ropes and logs, and you're going under barbed wire, and you're just, like I said, about 21 of them. You're doing a lot of climbing. You're doing a lot of
so you can pull your weight.
You can pull your weight.
I mean, you're also Tony Reyes. You can pull your weight. You can
sure.
do a pull up on a rope. That's something
sure.
I can never do. Your arms are strong enough to do that.
Yeah. So, and you know, and when you get to the academy, you realize that that we're probably not all, most of us are not in the shape we should be.
Well, you're 45 years old,
yes.
Tell me. And a 45-year-old is a lot different from a 25-year-old who's taken, or younger, who's come out of police force. I mean, our bodies are not as
smaller. I definitely wish I was going through that course when I was back in the academy.
Well, were you in that kind of shape when you went down there that you could just do a 9-mile course, including 3 miles of, I'm sorry, 6-mile course, including 2 miles of obstacles? Were you in that kind of shape when you started going down to Quantico?
Admittedly, no.
And I'm sure. What do you think? Any of those 224 people were?
I think many of them were. I think
A lot of cops go to the gym every day, right?
Well, I would tell you that probably, and I'm just guessing, probably 1/3 of them were. And I can tell you that there were some great stories of people that lost a ton of weight and got into incredible shape to go to the academy.
Oh, okay.
For a department like ours, we get slots more frequently. Although we haven't been to the academy, a representative of our department hasn't been to the academy probably in over 7 years. The fact is that we have more chances to go to the academy than some of these departments that have just 20 members.
And so you went down there, you had not been in the shape to do a 6-mile course. So when do you do the 6 miles? Is it the first day, or do you work up to it?
So you're working up, and that's the culmination of the program. That last week, you're running.
So that first week, how many miles did you run?
So the first week, you do a qualifier, and in order to qualify to do the program, you have to run the mile in under a certain amount of time.
And what's the certain amount of time?
So it's a maximum of 10 minutes for the men, and I believe it was 11 and a half
so
minutes.
Anyone
or so
anyone who's working out can do that?
I'm sorry?
People who are working out can do a 10-minute mile.
Yeah, right? And I think anyone with in moderate shape can do that, and I think 99% of the people did do it.
Did anyone fail?
No, yeah, a few people did.
Did they get kicked out of the academy?
No, so you get put into an alternate program where
the losers program.
Well, not necessarily, but
felt bad.
Well, it's an alternate program that gives you that you're still going to get another chance to qualify to run the Yellow Brick Road back in week 8. So in week 8, you have one more opportunity to qualify to run the Yellow Brick Road.
So you qualified.
So I qualified that first week.
Before you went, had you been working out in general? Like, do you work?
I was.
You got long hours. You got it. Yeah, you got a family.
It's tough to keep a schedule, but that's, you know, it's, let's be honest, that's just an excuse. We got to make the time to work out and to stay healthy. And I think that was probably one of the main focuses of the academy is officer wellness and really focusing on the fact that the job is innately stressful. It has all the challenges that it has, and it's enormously important for us to stay healthy and to...
I guess in a high-stress job, if you're not working out, the alternatives are like drugs and stuff. So, you know,
absolutely.
So you went there in okay shape then?
I was.
But not Yellow Brick Road shape?
No.
Were you intimidated, Tony Reyes, about knowing that at the end of this program you were going to have to run that 6 miles and 6.1 and...
I wasn't intimidated. I do very well with challenges. I would do very well with, you know, sort of setting goals and having that and having those challenges ahead of me. That sort of drives me. It's a motivator for me. So I wasn't necessarily intimidated, but a lot of hype was made. It's interesting because I underplayed the whole process of the Yellow Brick Road, to be honest with you. I didn't think it was as, you know, a big of a deal as it was. Most people that I spoke to, and I said, listen, I'm going to the academy, and people that had heard about it, guys have been on a job, retired guys, and say, hey, make sure you get that yellow brick. Don't shame us. Make sure you come back with the yellow brick.
They give you a yellow brick at the end? That's what it's named?
I did, yeah. And so then that's when it started hitting me. I'm saying, wait a minute, this is a pretty big deal. I hope I don't mess this up and not bring a yellow brick back. But other than that,
Were you a jock when you were growing up?
I wasn't involved in organized sports, but I played a lot of sports growing up.
Because I got the impression a lot of cops are jocks. They like playing hockey or basketball, and they love rooting for sports teams and stuff.
Yeah, I would probably say that's pretty accurate, that they're pretty active.
But
you
were never
a jock,
but you do work out. And the Yellow Brick Road, so you had how much anticipation did you have? When you were going to Quantico and saying, I'm going to this FBI Academy, this is a real honor, 7 years, no New Havener has been there. It's going to teach me a lot about executive management of a police department, what's happening policing. In that frame of mind, how big a deal was the Yellow Brick Road?
I think that... I think it only became a big deal for me once I started hearing from others about how much of a big deal it was. Like
that's like when you go into junior
high school. I kind of looked at it as a foregone conclusion.
Beat up in the halls or something. Yeah. 'Cause everyone's so big.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of looked at it as a, you know, I never thought that I wouldn't pass it, but I didn't realize it was such a big deal. And so you start kind of going, well, I hope I don't mess this up. But I went there more for the experience and more for the academic, you know, aspect of going to the academy. I thought it was a great opportunity to learn from other executives and to learn from people in the field and instructors and learn about, you know, advanced police principles and also to see how we measure up. I mean, to be honest with you, you know, we do policing in New Haven and we like to believe we do very well. But the reality of the matter is that we're speck in this big ocean and there's a lot of policing going on out there, and to be able to sort of compare notes and to see how well we are faring or not faring as compared to these other departments, it was an incredible opportunity to do that.
And that's interesting. We're talking about the opportunity that our guest today, Assistant Chief Tony Reyes, had recently going to an almost three-month FBI academy in Quantico, Virginia, where an elite class of police executives from around the country get together, run a six-mile obstacle course, but more importantly, learn what's going on policing and how departments need to be run today. If you had to think of one big surprise you had, oh, by the way, you got Elizabeth Martinez Cordova wrote in on Facebook Live, say, may New Haven have safety or whatever. Just write in. Edward Trimble from The Hill is listening in.
Awesome. And how are you?
I know he's had a lot of interaction with the police over the years.
Yes, I've had the pleasure of having personal interaction with Mr. Trimble.
So Chief Reyes, tell me something that you found out that surprised you at the FBI Academy about what's going on in policing.
I think the biggest surprise, considering that we had so many people from around the world, not just the United States, was how similar our challenges are. Considering that, you know, there are vast differences, even when you go to the West Coast and you compare the West Coast and how they do policing to the East Coast. But really to hear from people from across the pond and from even countries like, you know, like Palestine and Moldova and Mongolia and India, and to see that their challenges are very similar to the challenges.
So tell me about someone you met from one of those countries and something that person told you.
I'm sorry, repeat that?
Tell me about someone you met from one of those countries and something that person told you.
Well, I mean, clearly some of the stuff that that sticks out to me are, you know, that you know, that some of these countries are dealing with the realities of everyday terrorism. And it puts what we do every day in perspective. You know, one of the participants there, which, you know, became a very dear friend of mine, and I'm sure we'll have lifelong friendship, was a high-ranking member of the federal police in Palestine. And he,
by, you know, Palestine, do you mean Israeli police, yeah, or Arab-Palestinian police?
Arab-Palestinian police.
And you're talking about Gaza, or you're talking about West Bank?
I think he's from Gaza, but I'm not sure. And what he told me was that, what he told me was the reality of their police is that every day he goes to work, he has to check underneath his car.
Because there might be a bomb.
And so, you know, that was kind of sobering for us.
Whereas what you have to check is make sure no one wrote something mean about you on
exactly.
Facebook anonymously. Yeah.
It may not be that simplistic, but for sure, I mean, clearly.
Well, you could be in a situation where someone could shoot you.
Clearly it's not as, yeah, correct. Clearly it's not as dire as
and
it
yet,
is there.
Isn't it true that among police officers in this country, ever since the Texas, and there's so many instances like this we forget about, I mean, after focusing on intensely for 20 seconds, I think it was a year and a half ago in the summer, when the police officer was killed in Texas. And isn't there a sense among police officers right now in America that there's a heightened concern that you might be targets of people who don't like police, at the same time that there's a heightened pressure on police department from members of the public who are more aware than before of incidents of police treating civilians badly because of the rise of social media? Would you say that both of those factors were in play when you were in Quantico?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That was probably part of the everyday conversation we were having in the various classes. A lot of concern about how to lead our officers during a time where there's such a, it appears to be such negative sentiment towards police, and where the challenges that police are facing, have, you know, seem to be even more complex. So definitely, we talked about the officer safety issue, and you know, we also talked about trying to keep officers focused. That, you know, the advent of social media certainly, you know, magnifies, you know, this notion of negative public perception. The reality is, and we see that, and I saw it as recently as yesterday. I was doing a walk, a ride along. My apologies, with a few of my officers, and I rode with them for about 5 hours. You know what I saw? I saw a community that was very engaged with the officers.
What parts of town?
I was in New Hallville. I was all around Kensington and in those areas, Beaver Hills.
You were in the hot spots.
Yeah.
And you're saying, by saying engaged, what that mean? People who knew
people that were themselves, as we drove by, just saying hello to the officers. Our officers knew their names. They were saying hi. I did not see that negative sentiment.
No one flipped the bird.
Not at all.
Well, here's what I want to know about social media. And this isn't just about policing. It's about every aspect of our life, whether it's disasters or... You talked about magnifying. So I don't know, is there any social science research that in fact there are more negative views about police than before? I mean, my take always was a majority of the country very much supports the police. And we found that in 68 when everyone thought it was going to be against the police because of the riot at Chicago Convention. In fact, it was the exact opposite. Richard Nixon got elected. To nowadays with Trump taps into with people's, I always just wondered whether social media magnifies the voices, not always unfairly. It's good to have minority voices heard. Magnifies the voices of people who have concerns, but do you think there's a change? Did people at this conference believe that feelings have gotten more negative, or just that the negative feelings are more out there and putting you more at risk?
Well, I think both. I think there were some people that felt that there had been an increased negative sentiment, and I think, you know, there were some that just felt that it was just being more magnified than it ever was.
So before. What do they want to do about it? What do some of these top cops you met at Quantico, Virginia, at the FBI Academy, believe should be done in response to this?
Well, it was refreshing to see that I think that the prevalent mindset was that we needed to have more community engagement, that we needed to have more, you know, more conversation. And that,
what does community engagement mean? Does it mean showing up at neighborhood meetings? Does it mean just hanging out more in the street, talking to people?
I think it means all of that. I think it means that we are being cognizant of the fact that we have to be whatever it is we need to be. If it means that we need to engage more in the community because there's some things that are going on that you know, we need to be a part of it in terms of, let's say there's some proactive protesting. There's some protesting, and we need to be part of that. We need to let the community know that we're supporting their right to protest, and we need to proactively reach out to these protesters and say, listen, how can we help you do this safely? How can we help you do this in a way that allows you to engage in your constitutional right while allowing us to keep the public safe and
interesting what that means order. When you're a top cop. So since you've been assistant chief, for instance, I don't know if you ever thought you'd be doing things like this when you were a beat cop. There was an art exhibit at Art Space in Orange Street, and there was a cop pig sculpture.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And they got excited because it was controversial, which an artist likes to bring an issue. And to be honest, we wrote about it on The Independent. People were interested, but in honest, I would guess 98% of New Haven didn't even know the thing existed.
Right.
And yet you and the chief were present at a forum with, what, about 15 people talking about it. Is that community engagement, and how do you keep that in perspective?
I do think that's community engagement, and I think it's important for us to be part of difficult conversations and for us to embrace the fact that people have either preconceived notions or negative feelings about police. That we have to embrace that, and that's part of our history. And we have to respect that, and we have to be okay with being part of that conversation, being present, listening, and also taking the opportunity to try to engage in meaningful dialogue that might help change that narrative.
Well, you're listening to Dateline New Haven on WNHH Radio, your home for community radio, 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. Thanks for the people who've been checking in on Facebook Live. We're here with Antonio Reyes, the Assistant Chief of New Haven's Police Department, who just got back from a grueling and, he said, inspiring 3 months in Quantico, Virginia at the FBI Academy. So tell me about, in the courses, what's something you learned in one of these FBI courses that you didn't know before that you're bringing back to New Haven?
You know, I have to say that I think that some of the most meaningful aspects of the courses was the engagement with other law enforcement officials and the executives. And I think one of the things that I didn't realize is how little effort we're putting into officer wellness around the country. I realized how far ahead we are of many departments in terms of really paying attention and getting involved in improving the wellness of our officers.
What is officer wellness? Does it mean working out? Does it mean having an EAP, appointing an assistant program? What is wellness?
Officer wellness is providing our officers a way to engage in healthy, you know, engage in healthy ways of decompressing. It's providing an environment that was really contrary to the culture of policing, which was an environment where officers can talk about whatever it is they're feeling, if they are stressed out about the job, if they're going through something personal, things that impact us on a day-to-day basis, but are magnified when you have to go out there and deal with
the rather than suck it up, you mean?
Rather than suck it up.
And
so it's about having an officer who is not just physically fit, who is emotionally fit, is mentally and spiritually fit. And, you know, we all walk into the job and the job has an impact on us mentally, physically, and spiritually. And we need to be cognizant of that because that impact can have an impact on the way you present to the public, and it can impact on your health. And as we know, officers probably lead every other profession in suicide, alcoholism, and divorce.
Even dentists? I've heard dentists are high on suicide. A dentist once told me that while he's drilling into my teeth.
Okay.
So wow. So you came back with this message about wellness, talking out tough situations, and boy, did you get a chance to apply it. So yeah. You come right back, and this past Saturday, a hold-up shooter shot his wife, shot two cops.
Yes.
You guys are surrounding. He's shooting at you. And these cops, a SWAT team was called in. Two cops were hit.
Yes.
How did you apply those lessons from Quantico there?
Engaging our officers.
So what does that mean?
Talking. The first and foremost is being there for them, showing them that you care, creating an environment where people can express how they're feeling, making sure that people are okay, that their families are okay, and providing them the support that they need during a time where clearly they had a brush with death and they're dealing with a whole slew of emotions.
So what does that mean specifically? Like Mayor Harp talked about being with the SWAT team at the hospital. What were there one-on-one sessions with everybody who physically saw the encounter? Were there sessions for people who weren't there but are worried about themselves? Were there specific things you had to do with officers who responded to the call and saw bullets go by?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's all of that, Paul. I think it starts off with our presence there, and then it starts off with supporting the families who got those calls that no family wants to get.
So what does it mean to support a family?
Support a family, letting them know that there are resources available for them, letting them know that we are going to be with their family member, with this officer throughout this process, explaining to them what that process is. Reassuring them that we're going to provide resources to this officer that are going to help
them
be whole
again. What does resources mean? Psychological or
EAP? We're going to provide them resources within the department if they need extra time off. We're going to provide them, you know, counseling. We're going to provide them peer support. We're going to provide him whatever that officer needs, and that's different with everyone, Paul. I mean, you know, everyone has different. A reaction to trauma.
And at different times, right?
And some at different people, times, and they can present themselves. But
like, could it be 4 months later, they're patrolling and something just ignites
I think part of officer wellness is education. And I think oftentimes we don't know what we don't know, right? And so I think it's important to educate our officers about how these sort of, how this impact sort of can present itself. You know, it could, like you said, it could be a year from now. It could, you know, as we know, and this type of stuff is cumulative. And, you know, when you talk about PTSD, when you talk about your reactions to trauma, it's a cumulative effect, and you really never know how and when it's going to affect you.
So you said you already knew that before you left. You say you got a new appreciation for the importance of officer wellness. Was there anything specific you did this weekend because of what you learned in Quantico?
I reached out to And again, as I told you, my realization was more one of actually feeling good that we do a lot of what's recommended in terms of best practice and officer wellness. But I focused more on not just the individuals that were impacted directly. I focused on what we would consider the ancillary figures in this incident. There's a lot of subplots that occurred here. And I felt good that me, the other assistant chiefs, the other leaders and of this department really focused on everyone that was involved in this incident and making sure that we understood how everyone was impacted and making sure that we provided everyone with that same level of support. And, you know, oftentimes we think about the two officers, and when you talk about this incident, you talk about the obvious. There were two officers that were struck by gunfire. But the reality is that there were other officers that were exposed to that gunfire as well and could have been shot. And I would submit to you that their level of trauma is equal, is probably equal. Again, it doesn't...
I'm still trying to figure out what was different, having besides the renewed importance, which is very important, you know, the renewed appreciation for wellness and talking to everybody. What might have happened differently because you went
to
Quantico?
So one of the things, one of the biggest impacts I had with officer wellness is listening to... Everyone had to do a presentation. Everyone had to talk about how one of these issues has impacted them personally, whether it's alcoholism or suicide or PTSD or anything like that. We were all tasked with doing a presentation to the class, and listening to these individuals talk about their personal experiences, whether through a family member or friend, their own personal issues, I realized how important this is. I realized how much this is on our officers' minds. Mm-hmm. And I realized how important it is to continue the fight to change the culture in policing of being the tough guy, not talking about it, and just coping with it. And
now you grew up in the Hill, right?
I did.
Did you think of cops as tough guys and you became a cop?
I did, of course I did.
How did that, tell me about a moment like that where you thought being human and being a cop was more than just being a tough guy.
Well, again, I spoke for my class in the academy. I was elected to do the speech at our graduation.
Oh, yeah?
Yes, I was.
Oh, wow.
And actually, part of what I said in my speech was exactly that. I said when I walked in, I expected to learn all there was to learn about tactical entries and shooting our weapons and all those hand to hand combats and everything else and policing, self defense and everything else, and I learned far more about human behavior, human interaction, about trying to see people where they are and about mutual respect and things like that. So. That's when I kind of realized what policing was all about, and then obviously putting it into practice. But I think there's a big disconnect in how people think police are and actually how we are and what our job is all about.
And we're talking about that on WNHH Radio's Dateline New Haven, here with Assistant Chief Antonio Reyes. We have a few more minutes here. He's just back from Quantico, Virginia, and the FBI Academy. Tell me about the most rewarding moment. Interaction you had either unofficially, was it finishing the Yellow Brick Road? What was that like? Was it a lunch you had or a coffee with someone from another country or another community? Was it giving the graduation speech? And was this like a valedictorian speech you gave, sort of thing?
But at my graduation for the academy, I mean, it wasn't this academy.
Oh,
it was
the New Haven
my
academy.
New Haven Police Academy.
So tell me, we were talking about police. A moment you won't forget
at the FBI Academy. There were many, Paul. I had. I had a lot of interaction with a lot of our international partners, and one of them spoke to me after and talked about how meaningful our interactions were and how important it was. And I hadn't really realized how challenging things were for someone that English is not their first language, and coming to a different country, not knowing what to expect, and being able to make an impact in his life and having him see how we do things here. And I was part of just one of the many experiences he had, but just being part of that positive. A lot of people went through some personal things there. People had a lot of loss people. We had our Houston officers, Houston executives that had to leave. That obviously that dealt with the flooding. We had an officer. We had a an executive whose house caught on fire.
We had, during the
event and had to leave. We had one of our colleagues that whose son is a professional. I mean, is a football player at Northwestern, an outstanding athlete, and suffered a major, major injury to his leg and broke his leg, and he had to leave. He came back, but and obviously we had our colleagues from Florida who dealt with the events in Florida and the uncertainty. Some of them ended up having to leave. One of them actually lived at in the Keys. And so I was really impressed with how all of us came together, and it showed the meaning and how meaningful it is to be part of this, fraternity, so to speak, which is the NA, and that everyone came together. And it's, listen, this is symbolic of policing. If you would have been there on Saturday, Paul, I think you would have been in awe of the response, and I'm not sure if you were, but you would have been in awe of the response that all law enforcement had, public safety personnel, fire department, our local, state, federal partners. They all showed up without a phone call. And without a phone call, everyone just showed up and said, "What do you need from us?" And they just didn't show up. They stayed there. They remained there. They've been part. They've
5 hours, right?
And beyond that, they stayed there and they provided us assistance. The West Haven Police Department provided us resources because they knew our officers were tapped out. Regional SWAT teams, everything. I mean, I can't tell you. And this epitomizes what policing is all about and the brotherhood of policing. And all my brothers and sisters from the academy kept sending me messages. This went national. And so I was hearing, comforting words from all of them, that their thoughts and prayers were with our officers.
You heard from people from your class.
Oh, yeah. A lot of them. A
couple of questions have come in. How important was it to have command-level officers physically at the scene, and why?
Well, when there's a couple of reasons. The main reason is that when something like this happens, it's important for the troops to see, that we're there. And so we talk to our troops. We convey to them that we care about them, that we support them. We hold them accountable. These are the times when we need to show them that we care. This is the time where you actually demonstrate.
And the other question was, had you handled media relations differently from how you would have handled them before Quantico?
That's a great question. And absolutely.
How so?
Absolutely. I think that, in policing in general, I think we have sort of this adverse reaction to the media. And we have to embrace the role of the media in policing. And we also have to leverage it to where we are engaging the media and helping to drive the narrative of policing. And the negative, I would submit to you that the negative narrative that's out there or the image of policing that's being portrayed out there, we're just as responsible for that.
So did something happen differently Saturday because of Quantico and how you handled the media?
Well, I think that probably the sentiment is that once there's an investigation, that we sort of say, we're
right,
not going to make a comment. We're not
going to
get
a statement.
The state takes it over. There's nothing we're going to comment here. And I think that the things that I learned in Quantico is that the community needs to hear from their local police department. And I don't think the community is expecting intimate details, but the public needs to know, listen, what happened here? And what can we expect moving forward?
And when the state steps in, we find out less than we otherwise would.
Absolutely.
I mean, what I got from my read as an editor, and I wasn't there because it was Sabbath, but we had a reporter there, mm-hmm. was that the police handled it very well. You did a couple of briefings. No question that, 99.9% of the people were very supportive of the police. The same was shot. So it wasn't anger at the police. What I did hear was people wished they had found out what happened at the moment. It was very skimpy. Not that you needed a lot of blow-by-blow, but when the officer shot the man in the building who had been holed up, had already shot two cops, had already shot his wife, no one was thinking the cops were wrong to go in there. And in fact, people thought the cops did a great job of not killing the guy. But they still would have, I just personally think that and this is a problem when the state steps in, it would have been good to tell people what the situation was when they walked in.
And I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that we, considering the fluidity of the incident, we tried to stay on top of all of that. One of the things that I did learn in the academy, but this is something that, you know, we've been discussing for the past few years, is that we need to do a better job of engaging in social media. And I think, you know, we have Dave Hartman is our PIO. He does an outstanding job. And
he's on top of social media. I found out
he's
from
absolutely
him
on top of it. And he's been preaching this. I can tell you Chief Generoso has been, even Chief Esserman was when he was here, was really trying to make that happen. I can tell you that we need to engage more in social media.
I mean, I think it was 5 years ago that Seattle police had a blogger. I mean, they've hired people to help them.
I think that's I think that's definitely the present, not even the future, the present, but it definitely needs to be our future, our immediate future. And we need to focus on creating a platform so that we can have that immediate engagement with the public, especially for instances like this when they need information quickly for public safety.
Getting back to Quantico here at the FBI Academy, was the discussion of weaponry. So now in our country, there's now the federal government is sending more military weapons to law enforcement, said to keep cops safer and communities mm-hmm. safer, you need to be better armed. Mm-hmm. In England, the cops don't carry guns for the most part.
Correct.
Was there any discussion of that at the academy about that whole question of what makes you and the public safer, more weapons or fewer?
Yeah, actually, you know, there was this concept of militarization versus modernization, right? And balancing the police's, the law enforcement's need to have better equipment with the concerns that the public has that the police are becoming more militaristic. And so, yeah, we did talk about that, and we did talk about striking that balance. Obviously, as you said, you know, the president has opened up access to those that equipment again. But, you know, I can tell you in New Haven that, you know, we're trying to do a better job of communicating to the public what we're doing and why we're doing it.
I guess, I think separate from which administrations in Washington, Americans just, we don't believe that cops should be unarmed. We think that's dangerous. We think that if you're going up against gangbangers who have Uzis, you basically don't bring a knife to a gunfight.
Correct.
In England, they feel they're safer without the guns. That's such a different frame of mind.
Well, it is, but you also have to put it in perspective. In England, there aren't as many guns. Guns are not as accessible.
Right. So we have a gun culture.
We have a gun culture, and so in England, you know, you might come across 100 people in England, and or 1,000, and one person may have a gun.
But you need to be ready for that person. That's the person
you
who
do need
the
to
cop.
Be ready, and they actually have units that can respond to incidents very quickly that are armed. So they are ready for that type of encounter. But their day-to-day officers, their bobbies, are not, because that is not a prevalent concern for them. That is not something that is much of an issue as it would be for officers in the United States. America is
everywhere you go, people are
armed. Everywhere, you know, people really enjoy their freedom to carry, and people do carry, and we need to be ready for that.
Well, I enjoy the freedom to talk about what's happening policing with Assistant Chief Antonio Reyes of the New Haven Police Department. Congratulations on completing the Yellow Brick Road and the whole course.
Thank you.
At the FBI Academy. Is there a formal name for the academy?
No, the FBI National Academy.
FBI National Academy. Well, congratulations.
Thank
on
you
doing
very
that.
Much, Paul. I appreciate you having me.
Making connections with fellow leading cops from around the country and the world, and for coming back to New Haven ready to bring us into the next.
I just want to again give a shout out to our officers, Officer Shumway and Officer Pacino, and we're wishing them well, and all the officers who are involved in this. They're a credit to the badge, and thank you for everyone for the outstanding support that we've received after this incident.
New Haven was definitely had their hearts open to these officers, and we're glad they're going to recover.
Thank you. And the right. victim is actually on the road to recovery as well, so we're grateful for that.
All right, and I'm grateful for everyone for joining us today on Dateline New Haven on WNH Radio. Thank you to the Yale New Haven Hospital for providing support for today's program. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD, A Plea for Peace. Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all day and all night long here at WNHH-FM, New Haven's home for community radio.